Howdy, campers. It's Lauren Marie Taylor, and you are listening to the Not the Final Girl podcast. Alrighty, everybody. As you probably know, Leah Kalish is joining us today, and you're probably saying to yourself, wait, what? But of course, you know Leah as Leah Ayers, who famously played Michelle in the classic horror flick, The Burning. You also saw her as Janice in Bloodsport opposite Jean-Claude Van Damme very, very, very early on in his career, not to mention countless other film and TV credits. You should go check out her IMDb page because it goes on forever. So take a listen today as Leah opens up about her lively career and also her current work, which is helping others to heal from what's called inherited family trauma, which you can learn more about by visiting her website, which is leahkalish.com. We'll have more details about that coming up at the end of this episode. A shout out to Julie D, Tom C, and Anne S for sponsoring this episode. Thank you. Check out patreon.com/notthefinalgirlpodcast to see how you can also get a shout out on a future episode and even some swag. Let's go. Hi, Leah. Welcome to the Not the Final Girl podcast. Thank you so much for taking time to chat with me today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Lauren. Thank you for having me.
I will say that we have one degree of separation with a few different things, and let's see if we can figure this out. So you were in a Meatloaf video, is that correct?
Yes.
What did you do in that? How wild is that?
There's a funny story about that, if you want me to share.
You bet.
I was working on The Edge of Night at the time, and I had the video to do at night, but in order to do it, they had to promise to get me back at my 7 a.m. call the next morning because I was working the next day as well on The Edge of Night. So finish work, you know, get in a bus with like Meatloaf's whole softball team. Those were all those guys. We go out to this diner on the New Jersey Turnpike. And we work literally all night. And it's so much fun because, you know, it was just really fun. And then literally, I mean, in that final shot where I'm sort of dressed as this angel, right? They literally at 6 a.m. or whatever it was to get me to work on time, I'm literally running and like taking off clothes and handing them to the person so I can get into the van. And they said, don't worry about it. Just change in the van, right? Just so that I just made it. And so then I go and I work the whole day. And then that night I had tickets to see Lena Horne. So I wasn't going to ruin those. So I literally was awake for like 48 hours doing that. It was a great experience.
That's tremendous. So our one degree of separation with that is in 1980 or 81, I believe. I was filming a movie with John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd, and I was doing an off-Broadway show at the same time. So after the show was over, they would come to the theater, pick me up, and take me out. So I kind of had a very similar life experience that you had in terms of being up all day and all night. One of the concerts they took me to was a Meatloaf concert.
Oh.
So that's our first one degree of separation. Another one is Carrick Glenn.
Oh, wow.
She was in The Burning with you, and she was in Girls' Night Out with me.
Oh.
Also filmed around the same time. So that's another one. And the third one, which is probably the most famous one degree of separation, is that Tom Savini bagged doing Friday the 13th Part 2 to do your movie.
Yes. Wow.
Before we start talking about the movies, I do have a question from Tom, and he is a friend of the podcast and a big fan of yours. You're from Baltimore, right?
Yes, I grew up in Baltimore.
Okay, he wanted to know which area of Baltimore you're from.
I grew up in Roland Park, and yeah, I went to school right there. Mm-hmm. I went to Calvert School, I went to Roland Park Country School, lived in Roland Park. If you go a little bit past Johns Hopkins University, or Johns Hopkins University is sort of at one end where Roland Park ends, and then it becomes more, I guess, downtown, you know, like more part of like the outskirts of downtown Baltimore.
Tell me a little bit more about your background and your early career. How did you get started? Were you doing anything locally in Baltimore when you were younger, or did you wait until you came to New York?
Well, I grew up in a family that believed that team sports, you know, was the thing and built character. And I was athletic. In our family, we did everything. Tennis, you know, sailing, you know, exercise, climbing trees, you know, ice skating, skiing, wow. lacrosse, hockey I played at school. But I was also, I took ballet classes since I was five, and I really loved it. And then we got a modern dance teacher at my high school. So in high school, I produced the first modern dance concert that they ever had. And I was in for 2 or 3 years in a row. I mean, I was one of the leads in the play mm-hmm. that we did. My mother taught creative dramatics. You know, we had always been taken to theater, museums. You know, my father used to take us to old movies. So I knew that world. And so I remember when I left playing, you know, team sports to dance more. And my father was upset. But that's what I wanted to do. And then I was sort of on a fast track. So I actually graduated from high school in 3 years and went off to Tufts University. And they had like an okay dance program. But after a couple of years, there wasn't more for me to do. So I actually transferred to NYU. And I got in and I got a dance degree, a dance education degree from NYU. And I was dancing with a modern dance company. And I performed at this Dance in America when they started to film dances. The American Dance Festival, but you don't make any money. So really, I sort of backdoored accidentally into doing commercials as purely a way to make a living.
How did you find that?
Because I didn't have any other skills, really. Well, a photographer that I met, you know, I thought, I got to make some money. So I asked him, and he said, you can talk. You should do commercials.
You can talk?
Well, yeah. He said, how can I do that? And he knew of an agency in New York that had 1 hour a week. This is back in the late 70s, 1 hour a week where you could just show up. And they would, you know, they had 1 hour where people could just show up. So I got the address. I literally had just a snapshot of me that I blew up to an 8x10 as a headshot. Uh-huh. I walk into this place. It was Fifi Osgard.
Oh, I remember that. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I walk in and there's another woman, an older woman who's there, and she's handing her picture to someone. So I kind of get close, but not too close, and sort of listen in. And then when she's finished, I just kind of put my picture out and I say, okay, well, I'd like to do the same thing. And she looks at me and she's like, okay, she can see I really have no credits. I mean, so she goes, well, you wait here. And so I wait in a reception area. And I can see people walking by because the reception area had sort of like a half wall. And I could see people walking by looking at me. And then several minutes later, someone comes out and she said, well, will you read some copy for us? And I said, sure. But I literally did not know what the word copy meant. But I figured I'd figure it out. So they gave me this Stridex medicated pad copy. Then I was ushered into an office where there were several agents sort of with desks around the walls, right? So it was open in the middle. And I did the audition, and there was this little silence afterwards. And they said, you've never done this before? And I said, no, but I've seen commercials. How hard can it be? I said that because I wasn't a television watcher, really. And I was a modern dancer. I mean, that is a tough life.
Yeah.
You're talking rehearsal. We're talking trying to change costume, bumping butts with the person next to you because you don't have a dressing room. So I said that to them and they said, well, do you have a job? And I was a little embarrassed about that too, because I was still dancing, but I wasn't really having a job. And anyway, they said, sign up. Here's the information. We'll give you a call. You go to the address. You just do, you know, what you just did here. I was like, okay. First audition they sent me on, I got the job. The second audition, I got the job. And so I got Taft-Hartleyed into the union. A few years later, my agent said, Leah, somebody just called and asked for a Leah Ayers type.
You're kidding me.
I'm not Leah Ayers. I had fun with it. I had nothing on it. I wasn't seeking attention or approval. I really was just, I need to make a living and these are my skills. So great. Here's a place where I can use them. No stress. I could see often how stressed the director with the client, with the ad agency. I mean, you could feel all that. And I just wouldn't engage in it. I never let it bother me. I would have directors come to me and say, okay, look, just give it to me five different ways and be cute as shit and walk away. And to me, that was fun.
What was your reaction when you saw yourself on TV for the first time in a commercial?
Right away, I was like, wow, that, I gave it to the camera and the hair and makeup people because I had never seen myself as, you know, really that pretty or beautiful, and I wasn't treated that way. So it was like a new experience for me. And so I just gave it away, right, to that. You know, there were times where I would show up for a shoot, no makeup, fresh off my bike, which is how I got around New York City. And I could see the worry in their eyes, right? They couldn't imagine that this little waif walking in, probably weighed 105 pounds then, this waif walking in was going to be the Clairol whatever. And, you know, I was lucky enough to be able to talk and be able to, you know, be glamorized in a way that was believable. So I actually did really well when usually they would want a model, but for whatever the commercial was, they needed someone who could talk straight to camera for 24 seconds. I get called in.
But it was fun. You're right. It was a great way to make some money and a perfect way to get right into the union.
Yeah. And it was because of what happened with the commercials that then at Fifi Oscar Beat, the talent agent had a meeting with me, sent me on some auditions, and that I got, you know, a development deal with ABC. I started doing pilots, right? So that just happened. And to me, again, it was great. It was fun.
Your resume, I have to admit, it's just packed with people who are beyond famous, just people who America loves. What did you do? You had Bloodsport with Jean-Claude Van Damme, right?
Just, yeah, really, it was his first movie as a lead.
So he wasn't Jean-Claude Van Damme yet?
No. But it was the movie that made him Jean-Claude Van Damme.
You were a guest star on two of my favorite TV shows, Love Boat and Fantasy Island.
More than once, too. Right.
So we have Bloodsport with Jean-Claude Van Damme. Then we've got The Player, directed by Robert Altman. Leah actually is in the opening scene. What was that like when you heard Robert Altman and Tim Robbins? Did that blow your mind?
Well, I had actually met Bob Altman through a friend of mine who was good friends with his son. And then, you know, Bob has his own ideas about casting and this and that. And, you know, I'd met him a couple of times. And he thought of me, and he literally had me kind of audition or do something for him one time. And he said, "You're perfect for this." So that's how I got that role. I didn't even audition in the normal channels. And it was so educational and interesting and fun to be a part of that shot, that 8-minute shot that he does at the beginning of The Player without a cut.
Yeah.
Setting that up, choreographing. We did it like, I don't know, 17 times. Not that we didn't have it. And several of those were perfect, but I think he just wanted to have choices. But we rehearsed for a whole day and then we shot it for a day. It was a big deal, but really, really interesting. And it's just really fun to be a part of that whole project.
Did you know when you got the part how star-studded it was going to be?
No. No. He's Robert Altman, so, you know, he was, who knew who he was going to put together, right?
Okay, the next one, All That Jazz.
Oh, I have a really funny story about that. I auditioned for Bob. I had to go up to this, you know, abandoned building in Astoria where they were shooting all the hospital. Mm-hmm. I auditioned for Bob. Then I got the call later that I got the role. I had to show up, I think it was the next morning or maybe the morning after, but like right away. And I get up there, I get in costume and all that. And we go to where, you know, the sort of like the room where they're shooting it, and they bring Roy in, and he decides that Roy looks way too healthy. He needs to look paler, his whole body. So they call the makeup person in, but they make me help the makeup person literally put body makeup all over Roy because he needs to look sort of sicker than he used to look. And so we do that so we have time. You know, Bob's coming in and out, you know, the lighting people. But we're, you know, putting makeup on Bob and just on Roy, chatting away, la, la, la. And so there was a little comfortability that started to happen just because we did that. Then we get all ready. We know what we're doing. because Bob's going to say, oh, he thinks he's going to have an erection. And then I get all flustered. That's the scene.
Yes.
I'm massaging him as I've been told to do. And then he goes, oh, that feels so good. And then he says, oh, I think I'm going to have an erection. And I get all flustered. And so what happens when we shoot the scene, when he says erection, they shoot off a firecracker or a gun. And you literally, when you see the movie, you see me jump out of my skin. But I keep going with the scene. I did not know this was going to happen. But I stayed in the scene until Bob called cut. And after he called cut, everybody starts clapping. And he starts walking to me and he goes, I knew you would do it. I knew you would do it. And then everyone's exchanging money. They know that I'm this young actress. And he says, I'm going to shoot that off. And I bet you she's going to stay in character. She's going to stay with the scene. And other people bet against him. And that was my very first experience in a movie.
That is perfect. Okay, well, this is called the Not the Final Girl podcast. However, you have the distinction of being a final girl in The Burning. So that was the first movie role for Jason Alexander, right?
Yep.
Holly Hunter, Oscar Award winner, and Fisher Stevens, who's a big New York actor. When you were filming that movie with all of these now iconic actors, did you have any idea you were going to be this successful throughout your career?
Zero. We were all young, and this was an early job. Holly Hunter was off the bus. I remember. I mean, she showed up with the accent and the cowboy boots and the cutoff jean shorts, and she was like a baby. And so we were all, remember when you were 21?
Yeah.
Right. We were just young and hopeful and doing our best and having a good time. But I think it's worth noting here that the production was Bob and Harvey Weinstein's first movie produced.
And he was one of the writers.
They were concert promoters. And one of the things that we did while the 6 weeks shooting in North Tonawanda, New York, The Burning, was drive to, I guess it was Albany, Rochester, whatever the closest, I think it was Albany, because George Benson was performing. George Benson was giving a concert, and he was a client of Bob and Harvey as music producers. So we all got to go to the concert that was our one big fun outing as a group. And we got to go backstage afterwards. And I don't know if this is the right place, but I have a Harvey Weinstein story. It didn't have a bad ending, but just to say, his behavior started on his very first movie with me. However, he took me out to dinner, which seemed appropriate. We were in the hotel because there was no other place to eat. I mean, there was nothing in North Tonawanda but a roller skating rink and this hotel that also had a restaurant. And he was not there all the time. And he came, oh, I should take you out to dinner. So we had a nice dinner. And then when we walked back to the hotel, he just walked me to my door because he was probably down the hall or on the next floor. I mean, we were all in the same place. And yeah, I was just saying goodnight. I had nothing, nothing had happened that was not appropriate until all of a sudden I opened my door and I turned back to say, you know, thanks and goodnight. And he just tries to like hug me or try to kiss me or something. Oh. I was so surprised. And I don't know how I thought this quickly, but I did have the door open and I ducked down out of his sort of, you know, embrace. And I slid into the door of the room, right, that I had open. And I came down and around and started to push it closed. And he tried to open it. I hit his foot. I pounded on his hands and I shut the door and locked it and was so angry. I was so angry. I was seething. I had never had anything like that happen to me before. And I didn't know what to do at first, but the door was locked. He went away. And so the next morning, I was determined that this had to have a completion, that this was not okay. I wasn't. And the good news here was that I knew I mean, I wasn't so young and stupid that I didn't understand that I had the power position here, because this was a low budget movie. They were putting their own money into it. And if I decided to walk for good reason, they would have to shoot pretty much everything again with someone else.
Yeah.
And I could make a big fuss with Screen Actors Guild. I mean, so he saw me the next day, wherever he was at a distance. We were, you know, out on some location, and he did come to the set, and he could feel that I was just, you know, burning.
Yeah.
And he did sheepishly walk up to me and apologize, because he didn't want me to do anything.
Yeah.
And that was really clear. And I said, that was not okay. And that can't ever happen again to me or anybody else. And he was like, he tried to put it off like, oh, well, I don't usually drink, and I had a glass of champagne.
Right.
That's bullshit,
right?
You know, we had one glass of champagne each with dinner. So anyway, that did happen.
What a dick.
Yeah.
The Burning is set at a summer camp, just like Friday the 13th is. Were there any hijinks that went on to scare the girls where the guys scared the girls, or vice versa?
Yes, we had, we definitely did some of the camp, you know, short cheating or whatever you call that, fun stuff. It was interesting. It was almost like, because of the roles, Brian and I weren't included as much in some of that play that was happening with the campers, who were also younger. Not that we were very old, but
yeah, but they were a little younger.
Yeah, there was some of that, but everyone, you know, was having a good time. There was a big deal when they had to make that horrible head of Fisher Stevens that I find when I swim up to the raft, that everyone would be talking about how awful it was going to be, but I could never see it until we shot the scene.
Yeah.
So, but I would be hearing about it. And that was like the big fun thing, you know, when Leah finally gets surprised when she has to shoot that scene where she finds his head. Yeah.
Are you in touch with any of your Burning castmates, or any other castmates for that matter, that you've met throughout the years?
No. I mean, we're friendly. I remember running into Jason because we were both taking our kids to like a gymnastics class years ago.
Uh-huh.
I mean, my son is grown now, and so are his kids. But it was that kind of thing where when we see each other, it's all, you know, friendly and nice. But no, not like close friends.
In this section of the podcast, I usually ask everybody the same question, so it's kind of like a bit of a lightning round. But you can take your time answering, because you're not expecting any of these questions anyway. So, what is the most cringeworthy scene in any of your movies or on a TV show that you can recall thinking to yourself, oh, God, I don't want to see that on TV, or I don't want to see that on the big screen ever again?
Oh, what a great question. Well, the one I'm thinking of is A Love Boat, where I was this Southern floozy, and I had this just totally too revealing cut bathing suit on. I had this just Southern accent and silly hair. And I mean, it was fun to do the part, but when I saw it, I thought, oh, that's cringeworthy. It was kind of funny, but definitely cringeworthy as well.
Is there a role that you're most recognized for?
I would say Bloodsport's number one. My son just played me a shout out on some podcast where they were talking about The Player, but I wouldn't say that's number two. I think Bloodsport, The Edge of Night, soap operas,
yep,
when people remember you. Yeah, that's probably the biggest.
What kind of dog do you have?
I have two aging golden retrievers,
aww,
one of which is blind.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. Aww. But someone just came to the door downstairs, but fortunately my husband's home, so he should stop soon. Sorry about that.
That's okay. I've had to do it myself. When you've gone to conventions, what is the strangest thing that somebody has asked you to autograph?
Mostly it's, you know, pictures, posters. No one's asked me. Maybe it was a shirt.
Has there ever been a role that got away from you, that you auditioned for, that you thought, jeez, I wish I'd gotten that?
I guess this fits in with the cringeworthy too. I just, because you said that, I am also a singer. And I had a man who was just like a soulmate to me that I started taking lessons with, because I always was a singer, but I'd never taken lessons. So when I started working and making some money, I was introduced to him and we just hit it off instantly. And because of that relationship and collaboration, I mean, he was a genius. I was doing singing gigs, just cabaret things, but I also had auditions. And so there were actually two big Broadway shows that, you know, in the callbacks, I blew. One, Singing in the Rain, but I couldn't tap dance. I wasn't a good enough dancer, that kind of dancer, mm-hmm. for Twyla Tharp. I couldn't keep up. It was too fast. So that got away. But I don't know if you've seen Evita,
yeah.
but there's the part of the young mistress, mm-hmm. and she has one song. And I had auditions for that. I had been on stage. I had done so well. I was at the final callbacks. Mm-hmm. I am talking Meryl Streep. I'm talking Patti LuPone. And it's very different. The energy is different. And the lights are so bright that I can't see anyone in the audience. And I was young. I was so basically thrown that I couldn't sing well. I literally, it was like I lost my voice. It was so embarrassing because the minute it started happening and I got off, I realized, you know, I always put my attention on the other person or the people that I could see. And because I couldn't see anyone and I totally blew in the most embarrassing way the audition and had to, you know, just walk off 100% humiliated.
Knowing that you blew it.
Yeah. Oh, they were all cringing for me. Let's just put it that way.
That's actually a perfect segue into what you are working on now. You're doing incredible and groundbreaking work now having to do with, is it inherited family trauma, right? Did I get that right?
Yes.
Okay, good. Can you tell us about that?
I would be happy to, because it's the work that I do now full time. So,
what does inherited family?
Inherited family trauma is now a concept that we understand. It used to be more anecdotal. Angry father, angry son, depressed mother, depressed daughter, you know, eating, alcoholism, all kinds of different disorders. Like, what is that? And some of it's not just genetic. It's a way of being or thinking. And what we know is that trauma impacts the system, and the system, because it can't process it and doesn't want, you know, your body, your being to be overwhelmed, it will literally freeze the fight or flight response and take over and fragment the impact of that and store it in the body. And what we know now is if you don't complete trauma, we can start with the PTSD. You're in war, you're overwhelmed, you come home, the fragments of that overwhelming, the layers of that overwhelming experience are held in your body and can get triggered. Because in fact, the body doesn't want to keep carrying that around. It had to hold this emotional material so you didn't get overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. But now it's still holding it. And if you don't participate in a process that allows you to start unpacking that and metabolizing it and completing it, then, right, you have issues.
Right.
Because the body does want to complete this. And I'll give you an example in your own personal life so that you can sort of translate that to intergenerational. If you have a falling out with someone that you were close to, and then something happens and you don't complete it with them, maybe you part ways and you don't see that person for 10 years. If they walked in the room right now, all of those incomplete feelings would flood your body because they're incomplete. So most of us are organized around what we don't want to feel or can't deal with or don't know how to deal with, our parents included, right? And then they have children, but all that material is in the space. And as children, we feel it, we organize around it unconsciously. And that's one way that you can start to understand how trauma gets inherited, because it's not completed. It's still sort of living in the field.
How does a person recognize this within themselves and then ultimately heal or reverse this generational trauma?
Addressing inherited trauma, one of the therapies for that is called family constellations. And it was developed by a man named Bert Hellinger, who died, I guess, 2-3 years ago now. And what he saw, he, as a young man out of Germany, he wouldn't join the Nazi party, but instead he joined the Jesuits and got sent to South Africa to convert the Zulus. And he lived there for 14 years. And what happened was that he was so impacted by the health of that indigenous culture that was not true. There wasn't that same kind of health that he could see in Europe. All these emotional and mental problems and difficult family relationships. Didn't see that with the Zulus. Everyone knew their heritage. It's not that things didn't happen there, but whatever happened was included and addressed in a timely fashion. Mm-hmm. So you could say the emotional impact of a betrayal, or somebody stole something, or there was a bad accident, or someone was hurt, or someone wanted to leave the person they were married to because they fell in love with someone else. Whatever it was, all the normal things. Mm-hmm. Someone has a child die. Someone's mother dies early. But those things happen to all humans. But in this indigenous culture, they were processed. They were known by the community. They were atoned for. There was a healing. There was a grieving. And the story was told. And no one was forgotten. And those layers of the trauma got processed, so they didn't get carried forward. Bert Hellinger, he organized himself around systemic health. He called it the orders of love. He developed this whole idea of systemic health, just like we understand mind-body health now, right? They impact each other.
Yeah.
And then he started to see how trauma impacts the flow of that love and health. And if you can name it and include what happened, where it happened, mm-hmm. children stop trying to take care of their parents emotionally. And that differentiation allows people to get back into the flow of health, right? If you turn around because your mother lost her mother young, and you can feel that part of her, even though she doesn't talk about it or express it, she doesn't have her mother in the right place in her consciousness, the child will try to be her mother. The child, no one's thinking this, but energetically you see that that's what happened. And there's a big cost to the child, even though it feels like love, right? Because she's not receiving energy flowing forward. Because if mom didn't get that nurturing, mom doesn't have it to give. And then child tries to get it by nurturing mom. And now we have swimming upstream. You know, trauma decontextualized in a person looks like personality. It looks like, that's just the way they are. The same thing is true in a family system or a culture. We don't realize that we're organized by the trauma until we bring it to light. And when you do bring it to light, you name what needs to be named, or you include what needs to be included, and you see that you can actually bring your sort of unconscious way of holding your family into a new, healthier, conscious way of holding your family. And in that inner shift, life, you experience life differently. My teacher, Mark Willen, has written a wonderful book called It Didn't Start With You, How Inherited Trauma Shapes Who We Are and How to End the Cycle. I highly recommend it to anyone who's interested in understanding this work, because Mark explains not just the way I am about the feeling level, but he explains a little bit more about the science of epigenetics, which is now showing us how trauma actually impacts the body and the epigenomes. So how the DNA is really, sort of being chemically read, and why this stuff shows up. Anyway, it's a great book, and it has questions in it to ask yourself.
Would you mind if I asked you a question for a friend of mine?
Not at all.
Okay. My friend Julie has worked through many traumatic family traits. One she can't seem to push through is money. Her father died when she was 13, and ever since has been told there won't be any money. She cannot shake this as an adult. She lives in fear of money and struggle financially. She also said that she can't seem to truly believe in abundance. What tips would you give her on healing a specific trauma like this?
Well, I would recommend that she get that book. Working with someone is really good because when you work with a facilitator, the facilitator is holding the big picture and the space in which you can start to unpack the way that you're holding it. So from what you've shared with me already, I already know that your friend has collapsed loss of dad with loss of money. Right? They're the same. They've gotten what we call collapsed. So for her to have money on some level, it's as though she were letting go of her dad or letting go of how she holds the loss of her father. And often when we lose the people we love, we hold the loss of it rather than the having of it. If that makes sense. So I would encourage her to see and feel her father in spirit still with her. She's still half him. Though he died, he can't not be a part of her. And that I would encourage her to hold him as with her, as for her, so she can open up to the abundance of life, lifing. Right. And she doesn't have to have loss of money collapse with loss of dad, which she has to hold on to as a way to love dad. She can actually have dad and have money and let that be the way that she loves dad by letting him be there for her.
Cool. I know Julie will appreciate that. I know you have to go. Do you have any upcoming appearances, any conventions?
Oh, I just found out that I've been invited and I'm going to do... It's called HorrorCon LA, October 1st and 2nd.
We appreciate you, Leah. Thank you so much.
You are so welcome. It's really been a pleasure, Lauren. Wow. Really had a great time.
A big thank you once again to Leah for joining us on today's show. And also thank you to her barking dogs. You know as well as I do how much we love barking dogs in the background on the Not the Final Girl podcast. Did I just say dog? Sorry about that. I digress. Anyway, you can find Leah on Instagram at Leah_Kalish and check out her website. It's called LeahKalish.com. And if you're in the Los Angeles area in just a few weeks in October, you can catch her at the HorrorCon LA. And again, that's October 1st and 2nd. You can also find me on Instagram at LaurenMarieTaylor1. That's the number one behind my name. Thanks to you guys, too, for liking and subscribing and listening to the Not the Final Girl podcast. I really appreciate the feedback that you send me on my Instagram page. See you next time, everybody. Don't forget to keep your doors locked and stay out of the woods.